Good morning, good morning, good morning, and happy Wednesday to everyone who is tuning in to the show. I am so excited. It's so excited to bring you today's show. We were talking backstage, and today's show is going to be an amazing show. But you know what I got to ask you to do? I ask you to do the same thing Monday through Friday, and that is to go out and be an evangelist for the Roundtable Talk Show. There's someone who needs this information for their business, or maybe their personal life, but they won't know about the show unless you go ahead and share the show with them. So while you're going ahead and sharing the show with your friends, with your family, with your spouse, with your roommate, with your network, I don't know, while you're posting on social media, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our very first guest. And this lovely young lady is a dear friend of mine. I always enjoy when she's on the show. I've been able to watch her progress, where she started, where she is, but only the good Lord knows where she's going. Miss Andrea Hubert. Andrea was a disruptor at an early age. Just ask her middle school teachers who sent her home with daily report cards because she wouldn't stop talking in class. Having learned to better direct her love of words while holding tightly to her spirit, Andrea's passion for communication is now used to help her clients share messages that start conversations, inspire action, and drive revenue. Good morning, my dear. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing so well, Madam Chairperson.
I'm excited. Things are happening. But you took a major leap of your own. You stepped out on faith. You did some new things. Tell the people who don't know who you are, and what you do.
Okay. So I am Andrea. I am founder of Hub & Company, which I am just in the process of launching. Next month will be the big launch for it. And I work with creatives, people in creative roles, organizations, or individuals to help clarify and amplify their message, right? So everybody has a purpose. Everybody has a message. And I want to show some love to my creator community because it really is the backbone of everything. Just look at the other creators who are on the show today. Their stories are going to be fascinating, I know. And that's what excites me. And so that's why I choose to help creatives start the right conversations with their audience. Get their audience to take whatever action they're looking for them to take. I demystify all the technology that goes with marketing yourself, and I help them grow.
Okay, so I want to go back. That's wonderful. I love to see where people are, but I want to go back to this little girl who was talking in class, because even when I was reading that, I was like, oh, that's me. That's me. You know, I want to know how you learned to stop that, because let me tell you, my mom cured me.
Because
I would like finish all my work, and I could get finished in like in 15 minutes, and everybody else took like 2 hours. So since I was finished, I just walk around and talk to all the people. So the teachers would call my mom, and my mom told them, we'll give her some more work. And I was like, no, I don't want any more work. I'll be quiet. And that scared me.
My story. Okay, so I'm an only child. So going to school for me was just like going to see my friends. So every day, and this was in middle school, I would go and just talk during class. I would talk to the people next to me. I would pass notes. I just was very disruptive to the teachers. And finally, they called my mom into school and said, you know, that I was disrupting the class and that they were going to send home a daily report card of how disruptive I had been in all of the classes throughout the day. And then my mom said, that's great, because then I'll know what to do when she's home, you know, and we can make sure that she is not disruptive. Now, mind you, I was still paying attention. I was very good at staying focused and learning, but I was just so excited to be around other children. So after doing that for a few months, I quickly learned, well, I didn't quickly, it took me a few months to learn that I needed to stop, because although I was still learning, my friends were not having as good a, they weren't as focused as I was. And so finally my mom said to me one day when I was at home, and like you were talking, Sharifa, I was just asking all kinds of questions, just really getting on her nerves. And my mom used to say a couple things to me when I was in that chattiness. She'd either say, I know this is going to sound horrible, but she'd either say, go play in rush hour traffic. Or she didn't mean it in a And then she finally once said to me, you know, why do you talk so much? Why are you asking so many questions? What is it that you're trying to learn? And once she said that to me, I realized that my eagerness was not everybody else's eagerness. And so that's how I learned that, okay, maybe I just need to wait for somebody to open the door for me to start asking a bunch of questions.
So for me, I always say, like, I always, as a child, or at least a younger person, I was a little envious of people who always knew what they wanted to do. Like mm-hmm. people who always knew they wanted to be a pilot, a lawyer, doctor. I never knew what I wanted to be. Actually, I'm totally convinced I didn't want to do anything but sleep, but that's a whole nother story. But I've learned, you know, now my career is a talk show host. Like, I talk for a living. And my mom was like yours when she would be like, okay, would you please, like, I would talk nonstop. And she would be like, okay, just please, just a moment of silence.
Right. How, but,
you know, now I see how it's panned out in my life. How do you see that in your, show up in your life today?
So what I also used to do when I was younger is when we would be in a store and my mom would be trying things on and, you know, in the dressing room, I would just start chatting up people, total strangers, chatting up people, walking away from them. And so as I got older, I realized what I like to do is to learn people's stories. I like to get to know people, and then I like to connect them to other people. And so I think that I was meant to be in communications all along. I really believe that I was. It's always been natural for me. I've always done well in it. It's not a job for me. It really is just part of who I am. And I think that all of those missteps that I took to get to this point were, as I would think Marianne would say, you know, they were divine, right? They were given to me at birth. So.
You bet. I definitely believe that. I definitely believe that they're divine. Now, Andrea, I'm going to come back to you, but I want to go ahead, especially since we mentioned her, and go ahead and introduce our very next guest, the lovely young lady, Miss Marianne Gillespie. She is the first time author presenting a book that defines all the idioms, metaphysical language, esoteric imagery, and riddles of the Book of Revelation, which unlocks the message hidden within the symbolism from Jesus Christ. Good morning, Marianne. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm interested to learn more about you.
Well, there's not a lot about me that's very interesting, but I can relate to Andrea about being interested in other people's lives. I'd hoped the Lord would ask me to write a book on people's lives. I think the everyday person short circuits themselves a little bit because they have interests, and I just want to get someone talking about themselves, what they're doing, how they find the Lord, what happened, all these crises. Because I had a real crisis in 1972. I had a gun ready to kill myself.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah. And in my living room where I had the gun, taking it out of the bullets out of the box, I heard a voice. And it was like someone standing in my living room, standing up because the voice was above me, but I didn't see anything, and said, stop, why are you doing this? I gave you those two little children you begged me for, what would they do without you? All of a sudden I knew, only one that knew that I begged for children because I lost four. I thought, that's God. And then we began to talk to me about things. All of a sudden that night, everything just changed. And I opened up a Bible for the first time, really. I'd opened it up before, but I didn't know much about it. All of a sudden, it came alive. And I was voracious in my study of the Word of God. And I just couldn't get in. That was my new family. I had a family. And I had the Lord. I had somebody to walk with me through this. And all the voices I'd heard before to destroy myself because I was worthless, they disappeared. I never saw them again, never heard from them again. I had one voice, it was the Holy Spirit. And so in that, I became a voracious reader of other writers. And I wanted to learn about the Bible. I wanted to learn about Revelation. I was very drawn to that book. But I found something different than in some of the books I was looking at. I had a Christian bookstore for a few years, so I had available to me a lot of books. I read every one on the end times. The same doctrine was, and I thought, is there no room for anything else? Because I'm seeing some differences here. Who's studying these symbolism, this esoteric imagery? Well, I began to look into it and found out in the imagery, in the riddles, in the all of the symbolism, when I began to define the symbolism, a message came for it. Oh, so that, and it was different. I found some of the visions that actually come to pass in Revelation. I could find the historians proving it from way back to Martin Luther and even before that. And so I began to introduce a little bit of that to my classes that I was teaching in the Assembly of God. They didn't want to hear anything different. I said, well, at least look into it. So pretty soon I bagged that for a while until in 1985. I was driving home from Washington to Montana, back home from a writer's conference, the only one I ever went to. And I had a vision right in front of my, I was driving. I don't know how I got back home because it was right through my windshield and it said end time reapers. And I said, oh no, I gave this up. Are you kidding me? I have to write on this, all my notes and things. Well, I began to drag them out. I thought, okay, and the Lord began to speak. I'll save you the details on that. I needed some books. I needed some references. I couldn't afford them. He said, I'll supply you for you. So it's been a long study. And it still is rejected by the, they won't even be curious enough. I'm so curious. I ask question after question after question, drive pastors nuts, other people, just accept what is. And I said, I can't until it's proven. And one of the main things was when Jesus said in the end of Revelation, he is coming quickly with his reward. Well, I was so curious, what's that reward? It must be so important because it was mentioned with his return. And I'd asked him, he said, oh, it doesn't matter about a reward, just long as you're in heaven. I said, it's got to be important. So that set me really on my search to find out what that reward is. It took me a few years, but it's in the book.
And we're going to find out. It is important. Yes, absolutely. Oh,
it is very important. It has to do with the marriage supper that people think they're going to be part of. And they may not, they'll be in heaven. But if your house burns up at the judgment seat of Christ, you won't receive his reward.
Well, let's talk about that, Marianne. We definitely want to talk about a little bit more, but let me come back to you. I want to go ahead and introduce my next guest, Mr. Gerald Leonard. Gerald is an international keynote bassist and cultural change expert. His program integrates music, productivity, workplace culture, and neuroscience. He is the author of Culture is the Bass, 7 Steps to Creating High Performing Teams, listed on Entrepreneur Magazine as one of the top 15 books on business culture that you need to read today, and the book Workplace Jazz. He is the CEO of Principles of Execution, a strategic project. Good morning, Gerald. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am fine. I've never heard of anyone using music in the workplace in this way. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Gerald.
Okay, so I did my bachelor's and master's in music, and so obviously, you know, music has been a part of my life since I was 12 years old, and it's really helped me define who I am, because I used a lot of the principles in music and music training to kind of grow myself in various other areas of my life. And after college, I worked professionally in New York City, did some ministry work for a while. And then I decided I wanted to get back into music full-time, but I was married at the time and had a couple of kids. And I didn't want to be on the road because that wasn't how I was raised, with my dad being away. And so I played locally, but I got into IT at the time when you could spell IT, you could get in. Okay. And because I had leadership skills and management skills and the music skills, I was kind of like the right brain, left brain type person that was technical, but also business-wise. And I realized that I've always been someone who loved to organize chaos or organize things that were disorganized. And I was that way as a musician. Well, long story short, later on, I did a lot of speaking and everyone would come up and ask me about my music background. And how did that help me? And I started seeing the similarities, and I would also see similarities when I worked in a band or worked in a show or whatever, when I'm playing. And just the camaraderie and the relationships that are being built. And then when I worked on a consulting project with a really good team and saw things being delivered, and I saw the similarities. And so in doing that, I wrote my first book, Culture is the Bass, around the time, 2016, around the time that song All About That Bass came out. Everybody was singing that song. And so I talked to like that. In fact, I met with Dee and Willie Jolly. I don't know if you know Willie Jolly. who's a top speaker. Well, he and his wife coached me over a weekend with some other folks, and she really helped me to see that what I do is help companies change their culture. And then we kind of play with the idea, you know what? Just like music always has a great baseline, all great companies have a great culture. Uh-huh. And so that's where the birth of Culture is the Base came from. And I did a lot of research through, you know, Harvard and other institutions to kind of put everything together and came up with a framework. And then my second book came about after getting a literary agent and then having a publisher, and Workplace Jazz came about. And it's basically the concept of what can companies learn from jazz ensembles and how they work together, especially during this virtual time. And it's about 9 soft skills that whether you're working co-located or working together or your globally distributed team, how do you work together in a way that creates a groove, creates cohesion, and everyone's on the same page and making things happen, and everyone enjoys what they're doing. And the neuroscience came in. My son was born with some challenges, and so I did a lot of reading on neuroscience, but it also paid off because I started seeing the impact of, if you understand how the brain works, then, and you're understanding productivity and culture, you can realize and set things up where you can do them naturally and it feels right. And it's working the way we're created to work.
That is powerful. I love it. I'm going to come back to you, Gerald. I want to go back to Mary Ann for a minute. Now, Mary Ann, I usually don't ask this, so forgive me, you know, you never ask a lady her age, but you mentioned you got this revelation in 1972. That's like nearly 50 years from that revelation to that voice to actually publishing your book. You know, what was that process like for you?
Well, I think because I was seeing truth and reading after historians that long ago people weren't even quoting anymore, I found they were out there from the first century to the second century. And I thought these people were closer to the time these things were given. And I want to pay attention to them. And so that's where I stayed. But I found people like the doctrine that was purported by their mainline, well, all mainline denominations have the same thing, little variances. I've studied them all. And I thought, why do you want to be stuck there? There are some other things. Could we introduce them? So that drove me because I couldn't give it up. And I had these questions. I wish I could tell you, we don't have time. But I finally got them all answered. But even the one about the reward didn't come until the 2000s. I'm just dogged about it. That answer's in the word. And that one had to come out of the word, not even historians. And I dug that by putting the prophetic parables of Jesus Christ together in a row. Pretty soon the whole thing, I said, well, that's how you do it. And it opens up to you. And I made a whole different, I got it. I understand it. I finally had to have the Septuagint Bible to define the 70 weeks of Daniel to prove those 70 weeks have been fulfilled, and it's all in Josephus. If you just read it, and those have been fulfilled completely, although the mainline denominations say that hasn't been fulfilled yet, but it has, and I have all the proof in there, proof after proof after proof. So you can believe the evidence or not, but at least you'll have a different thought about it if you want to. Give yourself a chance. Don't be afraid. You don't have to accept it, but give it a chance. It might be something you'll be interested in.
Absolutely. Now, many people over history, over time, when they had certain visions, they were ridiculed. What was the response to your network and the people around you?
It was negative.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. How did you overcome that?
How to overcome it is, I so want people to give new things a chance. Look at it. You don't have to receive it. But check it out. Don't be afraid to check something out. I've read a lot of things I've rejected, but I checked it out to see, and then I compared it and all of that. But they're afraid that if they do, they're not going to be accepted. Well, I don't care. I want people to be set free. And there's a possibility that you might not, the Lord might be coming sooner than you think. But why would God give all these visions for some little time at the end of time? Why not all of church history? So I bring that in to show how these visions unfold, how many of them were for Israel. the Four Horsemen. I go into the history as to why, because there's so much in the Old Testament to connect with it, to show who are the two witnesses. Well, it answers it if you get into scripture, and it takes you clear to the Old Testament to the anointed ones and brings you right back to the two witnesses. It's not two men in a street. And symbolism is so important, but when you define it scripturally, it unfolds kind of like a flower unfolding. You get some facts, put them in a row. Oh, I never saw it that way before. And that's what I'm hoping for and believing for. And if God provided the publisher after all these years, then God is in this some way that he'll be glor-. I only want to glorify the Lord. I don't want to be right. I don't want to say Marianne did this or that. No, just read and see, is there a possibility you might have erred in that? So what? Say, okay, I went the wrong direction. Let's get up and let's go the right direction. That's how I've run my life. But some just are fearful of believing something and then think they're wrong. Well, so I've been wrong a lot. So what? So what? God just says, okay, keep going, get up, keep going. I'll give you the truth. And so that's what motivated me as I kept hearing the Holy Spirit. If you gave me that vision, that sure didn't come from the devil. Driving down the street, as I said, I don't even know how I got to where I was supposed to go, because I'm looking at this through the windshield. Watch this gradually come forth. And I said, that's a book. I'm talking to myself all alone in the car, you know, heading home. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is what he wants me to do. And I bagged that a few years before. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was 85. And so now look at here, we're way back in this era. Took a long time, but it was in God's hands. And if he wanted to publish, he's going to have to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Andrea, you had a question?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that it's not right to have questions and to seek answers when it comes to faith. Like somehow, you know, you're not a believer if you still have questions. And I just don't believe that at all. I think that we always have questions. That's how we continue to learn and grow in our faith. And I remember when I was younger, 10, 11, 12 years old, and I, you know, went to church, and the pastor had an altar call. And before I even knew what was happening, my mom was even surprised. I stood up, I went to the front, I went up to the pulpit, and I accepted Jesus as my Lord and Savior. Like I made the declaration that that's what I wanted to do. And then we had to go through these classes before we could actually be baptized. And I just remember I was pummeling the pastor with questions over and over and over and over. And in fact, he even said that when he baptized me, this was our toughest one. She asked so many questions. And I still am asking questions because that's how we grow. That's how we affirm our faith, is by seeking out whatever it is that we wonder about, right? Like,
yes, absolutely. Now, Gerald, you're an author as well. What was the process like for you to publish your first book?
Well, the first book was self-published. And so for that one, I was a part of the National Speakers Association. And so, you know, which is a great network of meeting speakers and writers. And so I was able to, you know, and I also read a lot. And so I was able to kind of through reading and through networking, through meeting people, kind of figure out, a methodology or a process. And then I ran into and met with an editor who had a lot of writing experience, who written for the New York Times and things like that, and was a music producer as well. And so we kind of collaborated and he shared some of the ropes with me. So, and then I did my own research on, you know, the best methods for how to write your book and get your book out of your head. And so that was kind of like the first experience of writing. The second experience was after having written a book and gone through that process, I had joined a group with Steve Harrison, gentleman, and that Jack Canfield had hired 20 years ago, and they still collaborate together. And so it's he has a lot of coaches in his program. And so one of them basically walked me through a process. It's called getting your manuscript out of your head and into a manuscript in 90 days. And it's a methodology or a process for how do you come up with an idea, flush it out, organize it, structure it, and really create a manuscript or a first draft within a 90-day period. And that's how I wrote my second book. And it was so much better because I took everything that I had learned from the first book and then applied that to the second book, but I also learned a lot of new information. And I think the value of feedback and coaches made all the difference. I don't think it would be as good of a book that it came out to be. I don't think it would have been published by a major publisher. I even had Brian Tracy give me a recommendation on it. And I got some other recommendations on the book. And so, you know, it was a learning experience. And I think, you know, as I look at my third book, it'll, you know, be another learning experience to kind of make it even better.
Absolutely. Now, Andrea, I know you help your clients get their messages out of their heads, help them share their message. Do you help any of your clients with writing books?
Not with writing the book, but with promoting the book. So
that's important.
Yeah. So that's my area of expertise is public relations and integrated communication. So I help clients get the word out about a book or about a launch or about a campaign or whatever it might be that they're trying to share with the world. So my work is usually after the thing is built.
I think that's very important though, because that's one of the number one questions that new authors have is like, I've written this book, it's done. You know, so many people, especially over the last year in this global pandemic, have been doing a lot of self-publishing, but they don't know how, they don't have a publishing firm or somebody who can support them in the marketing aspect of the book. Are there any recommendations or suggestions that you have for new authors?
Yes. I recommend if you're marketing the book yourself, if you're looking for PR on your own, a couple of things that I would recommend is getting a hit list of journalists, editors, producers, let's just call them media for generic sake, getting a hit list of media that you want to approach, starting to build relationships with them, because it's really not about your book. It is about what is your book going to do for their audience? How's your book going to help the audience? So build those relationships, become a trusted source. So maybe your book is not the right fit for an article that the person is writing right now, but you know somebody who is. Start to get into their good graces, because by the time you are ready to pitch your book because they're working on an article where it makes the most sense, they're going to be more likely to cover it because you have built this relationship and you've been a good source and you understand what their audience is looking for. Those are a couple of quick tips that I would say are foundational for starting.
And I would add to that, I would say one of the resources I used a lot, what that I found out about was called Help a Reporter Out. And it was really, really helpful. And I started responding to different requests that reporters had as far as comments. And next thing I knew, I found articles that had been quoted in CIO Magazine, Tech Republic Magazine. I ended up becoming a writer for PMO 360. And there's so many other things that happened because of that. And it was simply just kind of responding to a request from a reporter, which they were anonymous, so I didn't know who they were. But it was responding to a request to a reporter and kind of giving them my thoughts. And next thing I know, I was finding out that I was being quoted in all these different, you know, popular magazines. And it was starting to drive traffic to my website and more information about my books.
Yes, and you can see a lot of those requests. So Hero, it Help a Reporter Out, comes via email several times a day. And that's great. And then you can also see a lot of those journalistic requests, usually with shorter deadline, on Twitter. If you follow hashtag journal request, for instance, you know, and then you write and then you reply to them. And in both cases, making sure that you are providing the exact information that they're looking for, right? You're very detailed and you're not going on tangents, because to your point, Gerald, they're right. They already have the story framed. They know what they're looking for by the time they make the request. And so they're looking for the best response in the most timely manner to that specific request.
Exactly.
Interesting. Do you use social media to promote your book, Marianne?
I've only used Twitter. I'm not really yet. We said I'm 80 years old. I'm trying to learn about these things, although my publisher will promote it as a contract. And there's some things you can't do because they're involved in that. And every time I asked the Lord about it, he says, well, I'm your agent. Ooh. And he told me that before too, but I thought, well, okay, I have to do something. I'm a doer. Not only do I ask umpteen questions in my life, but I kind of am a doer. I want to get in and roll up my sleeves and do it. Can I show the cover of the book?
Absolutely. I love to see it.
Now, the cover of the book is what I saw in the vision. And it showed an angel coming up out of the clouds with a sickle in his hand and showing he's going to reap. And when we get into Matthew 13th chapter of the wheat and the tares and the return of the Lord, where end time reapers is actually mentioned in that parable. And so anyway, this is what I saw basically. I don't know how, if I can get it up here. And can you see it?
Well, yes. Yes.
Wow.
And so it does depict, but that's what I saw through the windshield that day, or at least a reasonable facsimile. It's not exact, but the angel coming up out of the clouds, the warrior angel, yes, and the reaping part. Because, and when I was watching that, I knew the scriptures. I said, well, that's right out of the scriptures. But I went on a search and later, not in that beginning, but later once I got a computer and everything, I put end time reapers in the search, see if somebody else has written a book on this. I didn't know. It's a very good subject, that's for sure. Because Jesus is a major end time reaper. Then he sends his angels out to reap the harvest for the wine press. And he sends his angels to reap his kids. I call them his kids and Satan's kids in the book to make it kind of simplistic. But there never has been that name when I would pull that up. And I thought, surely someone would have caught that name because it's kind of interesting, but I never found it.
So I'm just curious. I'm naturally inquisitive. That's the polite way
of saying it. All of us here, apparently. this podcast, we are. We all ask questions. That's really great.
I do. That's why I host talk shows. But yeah. I was kind of surprised by your answer when you said you use Twitter. Like, out of all the social medias, like, Twitter is my least favorite. I mean, for some reason, it's just like I can't get into the, like, mainly because I post more than I talk. I don't make a lot of personal comments or tweets or anything. I just post, you know, flyers for my show. So why Twitter?
I really don't know. When I didn't have a publisher for so long, and I said, how do I get the message out? And so I learned how to blog. And now it's all over the world. People are still, and I quit that in 2018. I did it for 5 years. And so I'd take a chapter and I'd condense it because blogs you need a lot shorter. So I learned how to blog and got on WordPress and blogger.com and all those. I just had to venture out and I gradually, the Lord showed me how to do it. I just say, please help me. This is so new. And he did. He provided help along the way, like he's done with all of you. And so you just ask and shake a little bit nervous and then it gets easier and easier. So 5 years I did the blog trying to present my book out there. Well, it got, I mean, I have probably 80 countries still reading that blog and bringing in information. I thought it's gone all over the world. So that was really impressive because I didn't know that's what would happen. And so then just as I kind of thought, well, I've done the whole book on there. There's nothing else to do then as a publisher. Asked to see a manuscript. So it's interesting in the timing on that. So anyway, so I did go on Twitter. I recopied it for Twitter and just learning how I didn't know how to do that. I thought they'd bump it off because it had so many words in it, but they didn't. They did, I could tell they were checking it out and all of that. But I've had several hundred views on that, but I have such a limited Facebook people. I have about under 100, you know, and a lot of people are dead by now. I don't, because of my age, they don't seem to be interacting on there. And so that's, and I don't know other venues at this point to be able to promote that. So I need to find out.
Okay.
Well, we don't talk. And I have people checking it out, you know, and they're looking at it. And so
Twitter makes sense to me because that's the platform where people like to have analytical and intellectual conversation. Mm-hmm. So it actually makes sense to me. I don't think that you would get the same reactions and responses on Facebook, LinkedIn, you know, any of the other platforms. I think that Twitter makes a lot of sense.
That's why I stay away from Twitter, because I do not like having intellectual conversations.
Yes, you
in
do.
In writing, I don't. You know what I mean? Like, because then they be like quoting me, like they quoting Gerald Sharifa Hardy's. Nah. I just post the flyers. You can't interpret my flyer. If you want to hear my thoughts, tune in weekdays at 8 a.m. to the Roundtable Talk Show. Gerald, you were going to say something?
No, I was just going to say, Marianne, you may want to look at some of the Facebook groups that have a biblical interest.
Sure. And how do you do that? And,
just search on and when you go into Facebook, just search for groups, and then just search for groups that have type in like biblical interest, and just see what comes up.
Then
sometimes they have groups that are a few million people. Obviously, it's like almost 2 billion people.
And I can do that on my own Facebook page.
Yes, you can. You can do that. Yeah, and plus you have all this content. I think what you've done, which at the time you didn't realize it because you're kind of stumbling forward as you're doing it.
Right.
What you did was brilliant, right? Was because in the process of developing your content for your book, you were blogging your book and you were building an audience without knowing that you were building an audience. Mm-hmm. And because blogging has such SEO friendly, algorithms and everything else, because it's looking at all of the content that you're putting out there and it's interesting stuff that you're writing about, and there's an audience that wants to know about it, it automatically, by the time the book got published, created this global audience of people who know about it. So I would go back to that blog, resurrect it, and start advertising your book on that blog.
Thank you.
Because sometimes people, instead of people wanting to just read through the whole blog, they would rather just buy the book and carry it around with them. So now they can mark it up and write in the corners of it. But you've done a lot of groundwork, and you can also tweet little sections from your blog and your book on Twitter and tag it back to your website with the images and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of different strategies that you can use
with what
you've already done.
Mm-hmm. I had forgotten about going back. I mean, the blog is reporting to me, but I didn't think about going ahead and putting the finished product on there again.
Yeah. In fact, Neil Patel, who's one of the top SEO and marketing folks, he basically says that he writes one new article a week, but his team goes back and updates old blog posts.
Oh.
And so because, the algorithms or whatever, they're constantly looking at what content you already have out there.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you have quite a bit of content from what you've done. Cause I looked at the size of your book and it's pretty thick.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot of research over the last 50 years to put that together. So kudos to you. But so you have tons of material to market and to share. And I think the two places, the platforms, which are Twitter and Facebook.
Blogger and WordPress.
Yeah, I would just leverage what you already have. It's kind of like Acres of Diamonds. You already got it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. This is really beneficial for me. I appreciate this help.
I also think two other marketing strategies that would work well for you, again, because of the nature of your content, one being podcasts. I think if you could figure out a good match of, and there's lots of them, which podcast would be the best for you to showcase the work, your book, and have the conversation around specific points within your book, that would be great, as well as email marketing. So as Gerald said, you have an audience from your blog. I don't know if you have an email or not, but if not, potentially starting an email list and, really having this two-way dialogue then with the people who are then part of your sphere of influence, right? The people who sign up for your email.
Great ideas. It's been so helpful to be on here today with you folks.
Thank you. That's what we do at the Roundtable Talk Show. We all experts, we all share information, and this is why I love doing the show, why it is my passion. And I definitely agree with one of the things that Gerald said with reinstating or reactivating your blog, because one of the things that people don't really notice, but they see it every day, is when you type or you search for anything on Google, what is the number one website that typically comes up first? and it's Wikipedia. And the reason is it's content. Content is king with search engines. So they give preference to websites that are blogs and content driven as opposed to e-commerce that's trying to just sell people stuff, especially if it's updated frequently. So the more you update it, the higher your chances are to come up at the top of search engines.
Oh, that, you know, there were some emails to let me know that. Long time ago before I was ready, I read some of that. Okay, this is really great information that I can set forth to present it at least. I know God's the agent, but getting it out there like it's on Twitter, I do check that because I, well, people are still checking it out and I'm an unknown person with all the different people I've hooked up with in a lot of newspapers and book publishers and all, I'm on their sites. So that way, I just really appreciate all your help. I just need that.
That's what we're here to do, to help each other one day at a time, one show at a time. But I want to go back to Andrea, real quick. One of the things that you do, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, is just helping them share their message. When people come to you with a message or a story or something they've been going through, what is like the typical reason that they reach out to you?
Usually it's because the message is not clear. They understand that it is not a well-structured message and therefore it is not reaching the audience in the way that they want to reach. That's one side. The second side is there's usually some barrier when it comes to the technology of sharing that message. So perhaps, you know, they have an audience, they have a CRM, so they have an audience of clients, but they don't know how to connect that with their email system, or they don't know how to connect that with their, you know, take the information and use it from a social perspective and take the data and make their messages tailored for the specific audience. They don't know how to segment, things like that. So it's either a big technology barrier or it really is on the clarification. And then once we address both of those issues, then they always want, which is smart, a strategy, then a communications plan.
Okay, so what does a communications plan look like? Is that like annual plan or small baby steps?
It can be. It could be a plan for a specific launch. So if, you know, when Gerald said he's writing a third book, so if he wanted a plan for launching that third book, we would start with pre-launch. You know, I don't want to start with, okay, the book's coming out March 1st, let's start a week prior, right? So we really want to back it up however long the runway needs to be, depending on if it's the first book, third book, whatever it is, right? So we would create that pre-launch plan. What are you going to do on what channel? What is the key message that you're going to be sharing? Who are you targeting? What is it that you want them to do with this information? And then how are you going to roll in what you've done pre-launch into the actual launch? What did those messages look like? And then even more important, what are you going to do after the launch, right? Because you built up all of this buzz, built up all of this goodwill, you had sales during the launch. What are you going to do now with the people who, in all honesty, could even be new to your world to keep them engaged with you, to keep nurturing them? So yeah, that's what a communications plan does.
Okay, well, Gerald, you have your communications plan?
I do. I'm actually working with a PR firm as well. And I built the communications plan based on having done my first book and what I had to do to kind of launch the first book. So when I started my second book, you know, I had like the 7th month out, 6 month out, 4 month out, 1 month out, and so on and so forth of what I was going to be doing to kind of get the ball rolling on that. But I do have a question for Andrea. Because you mentioned earlier that you work with creatives. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, creative industries. So musicians, dancers, artists, writers, architects, you know, anybody who is either it's an organization or an individual who is what we would call in the creative economy.
Right. And the reason I ask that is because part of my market is what I call corporate creatives. Mm-hmm. And I would kind of fit into that corporate creatives, right? It's like I went to college for music. I did my bachelor's in music, my master's in music, studied a professional year after that. And then I ended up, you know, becoming the CEO of my own company, two companies, and working, you know, with, you know, federal agencies and so on and so forth in the corporate world, right? Yes. And Fortune 500s and so on. And I think that we as corporate creatives bring something unique to that environment, because we didn't go through the traditional training of an engineer or a project manager, right? And most project managers, they kind of stumble upon it, but they didn't go through the corporate training from that perspective. So they kind of automatically think outside the box when it comes to how to get things done in corporations. And when I did in some research I did, I found that about 32% of the market revenue that's coming in, it's coming from folks who are like that, who are what I would call corporate creatives, are the creatives within the corporate environment. And I don't know if you've seen the same.
I do. And that's why I always say organizations, and I mean corporate, nonprofit, or an individual, as in an individual painter, writer, dancer, et cetera. And I think that that's a really good point, because people who are in creative roles inside of a corporate environment, typically when they hear creatives, they don't think of themselves. They think of themselves as corporate.
Right.
Right. So an in-house marketing department, it does not think of itself as creatives necessarily. They think of themselves as part of the corporate culture. And it's just not, it's not true, because when we think about creative economy or creatives, creative culture, we do include everybody. It doesn't matter the origin of the professional work, right? If you're doing it for somebody else or you're doing it for yourself, you are still producing creative work.
Right.
So one of the things that I've seen, Andrea, over the last year, at least, especially in this global pandemic, is you have more people who have more time to be creative. And then you have an expansion, explosion of people switching from brick and mortar to e-commerce. So there's a need to further stand out than ever before. Have you seen this with corporate creatives using more of their creative side as opposed to more of their corporate side?
Yes. You know, this whole term of side hustle, there are so many more people who may be in a creative role, right? They may be in-house creative somewhere, who are now dabbling in more personal creative endeavors outside of their work hours. And are starting to realize that there may be more potential in being independent, freelance, you know, gig economy, than being part of the corporate environment. I don't know the research on this, but I do know that there are more and more people who are making this transition, who have made this transition last year. And I think, not to go down a rabbit hole, but from a corporate standpoint,
I love rabbit holes, by the way.
So here's the backstory. When corporate environments they were not favorable for people who were freelancers, right? It was very hard as a freelancer to get work in a corporate environment, because you don't typically want to work on site. You don't have the same pay scale. They can't dictate the work, all of those things. It was a risk for corporate. Last year, though, there were more companies who were willing to take that risk, because they saw that remote work was still productive from the regular employees, right? So they were willing to take more of a risk and hire more freelancers to do the roles that they had to eliminate from a staff position. And I think that that's going to, I really believe that if it's not this year, it'll be next year, that there will be more roles fulfilled by freelancers than staff.
Yeah, I write about that in my book, in my second book. And it's interesting because I think there is a shift in leadership that has that also happened. And I talk about it from this perspective of you can't treat the modern worker now as just worker bees on an assembly line. Right. I mean, obviously, if you work on an assembly line, then that's what you do. That's right. Just the way it is. But for most corporate America, our corporate creatives are, and especially because of the pandemic, we've all been pushed behind a screen and working remotely, right? To some extent, unless you're an essential worker, and we definitely keep our prayers for them with all the things that they have to go through and challenges. But the other folks are bringing serious skills to the table. And I look at it from the standpoint, and this is where the music comes in with this, is I look at it from the standpoint of leadership has become much more like a conductor.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of conductor, whether it's a, you know, Duke Ellington Symphony or, you know, Wynton Marsalis's, you know, Lincoln Center Orchestra or, you know, the New York Philharmonic. What does a conductor do? Well, he comes on stage, he's already studied the piece, he knows the big picture, and when he's working with the orchestra and rehearsing, his whole purpose is to get them to understand the big picture and to leverage their skills to bring the best out for creating this huge, this big picture. But he doesn't do management by walking around. Can you imagine a conductor doing management by walking around? He wouldn't be a conductor, right?
Right.
He'd be a janitor or something. And he couldn't be a micromanager because you can't, you know, if somebody's sitting on the first cello and he has a PhD in cello, what are you going to tell him? What are you going to tell him? Right. He already knows how to play his part. And he knows how to bring that and help, to, help lead the rest of the group to that level. So that as the conductor, your job is to really motivate, encourage, and cast that big picture and orchestrate and coordinate the work and let the experts. But that also requires you to have trust and respect for the people who are doing the work, which means you got to really treat them differently and trust that, like you said, with remote workers, that they are actually doing work and getting things done and that they're there to deliver and you trust them as an expert because they've put time into learning their craft as well. And I think more people today are like artists than worker bees.
Right.
I definitely agree. And it's so interesting that you say that because I was having a conversation maybe a few months ago when I was describing the roundtable talk show. And I was like, I think of myself more as a conductor, you know, than a mediator, because I don't really like to mediate. I just like to conduct to make sure that the music and the show flows the way the show is going to go. I've had so much fun today. I've learned, I've laughed, great show. Now we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show. We only have a few minutes, but what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience. The show live as well as everyone who is watching in the archives and let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today. And we're going to start with you, Miss Marianne.
Okay. I think the most important thing would be that when I mentioned Daniel's vision has been fulfilled and I prove it, it means that everything was built on that foundation is questionable. And that the doctrine of the mainstream denominations, I would say almost not 100%, but large, is only 100 years old. And it started out with Cyrus Goldfield in the 1900s, early 1900s, in his publishing of his book and his Bible. And, but when you look at church history, finally didn't believe it, but people assume it because they don't know the history. And it's so important to look at the Bible facts, what it has to say, and especially about that reward.
And where can people find a copy of your book?
Okay, waldorfpublishing.com is be the first place, and then it's going to be available on all the other venues that are available. Just put in your search engine, where, you know, whether it's Barnes and Noble or whoever. And anyway, but I think they'll be worth their research to check out another idea.
Absolutely. And if people want to find out what you're up to, how can they follow you on Twitter?
I think it's at illuminator813.com. My handle is illuminator813 on Twitter.
Okay, illuminator813. You have to follow at illuminator813. Thank you.
And my name, Marianne Gillespie, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Have to check it out. Follow, see what you're up to. See if that wall came back to life. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You are so welcome. Gerald, what do you want our audience to take away today?
Okay, so I would say, think about what happened in 2020. The technology advances that were planned for the next 5 years actually got rolled into 2020. Because of the pandemic, there were technology advances that had to be made so people could work remotely and, you know, economies could keep going. And it happened globally, which means that the learning curve for the rest of our lives, even before then, but for the rest of our lives has actually increased. And so I would say, be a lifelong learner. And you do that by just one day at a time being a just-in-time learner. And sometimes it really gets down to, I need to learn something today to get this job done, but I'm going to learn it. And so I'm going to walk away from the end of the day having learned something new. But if you do that every day, that makes you a lifelong learner. And, you know, who knows, we'll all be like Marianne at 80 years old using Twitter. And doing some incredible stuff because we've decided to be a lifelong learner.
Right.
Absolutely. So where can people check out some of your books?
Well, my book can be found at its publisher's website, Business Expert Press, or anywhere globally. It's in all the bookstores. It's in all the online stores. It's at Walmart. It's at all the different places. And if they want to learn more about me, you can check out the book's website, which is www.workplace-jazz.com. Workplace-jazz.com.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you this, Gerald. You're going to have to help me out because I work like an hour a day by myself. So how can I incorporate jazz into my workplace?
One of the things that you can do as a jazz musician, jazz musicians always practice. So it's not just about the concept of listening to music. It's, well, what's the mindset of a jazz musician? Well, as a jazz musician, you're always working on your chops. You're always looking, how can I get better at what I'm doing? How can I learn from other experts and what they're doing? How can I find innovative ways to do something that I played this song this way last night? What's other innovative ways I can use that same content? And so the workplace jazz mindset is about being agile and about being innovative in our thinking, not so much about music itself.
I love that. So I got to keep working on my chops. I have to change it up, make it a little bit different, make the music sound different from the same show. Thank you, Gerald, for that advice. Andrea, go ahead and take us out.
Okay. So what I would love to share is that marketing is about building relationships with your audience, with the media, with your peers. It doesn't matter who you are trying to reach. It all starts with a relationship. They want to get to know you. They want to know that you understand them. And that's where, you know, making sure that the communications that you send out are value-based, right? Your principles, right? They're based on your principles, because that's the only way that I'm going to know if you and I are going to work well together is if we have the same belief system, that your personality shines through. I need to know that we vibe together. And then also adding in, I always shake my shoulders when I say this, a little bit of panache, right? We want to make sure that we are standing out, which is why I really love this whole concept of workplace jazz. You know, that's what I call panache, right? So really start building relationships, start thinking about when you're marketing, because that also is a mindset thing too. When you're marketing, you are building a relationship, you are starting a conversation. And if you think about it that way, it becomes a lot easier.
Okay, so let me just ask you this. What if I'm just selling a product and I just have a shoe store, or I sell coats or something? How do you develop your own personal, you know, your personality in retail, I guess is the question.
As the owner of the boutique?
Yes.
Well, as the owner of the boutique, the merchandise that you sell is your personality, right? Because you wouldn't be drawn to it if it didn't somehow speak to you. And then of course the other side of the equation is, and that you know that it would speak to the people who would be patrons of your store. So I just think that the more we stay true to ourselves, the more our personality is going to show through.
I love it. We learned so much, and we have definitely learned so much today. I just love this show. I love the fact that Marianne Gillespie is out there at 80 years old, yeah, telling her story, has a book, published it, and she's on Twitter. Now I feel bad. Now I have to tweet some more just because Marianne is tweeting. Like, I'm very competitive, but this has been a great show. I want to thank you all for being guests on today's episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. And I especially want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch the show live. The people who tune in every day, good morning to you. Thank you. I appreciate you. There are so many more people who are sharing the show, tuning in to watch the show. We are definitely building a following, and I wouldn't be able to do it without your support, as well as the guests being here today each morning. The guests are here to share their stories, their information, their expertise. So I always ask, please support our guests. Their website links are is in the Facebook post, but follow them on social media. Reach out to them, ask your questions. And when you reach out to them, please let them know Sharifa Hardy says hi. Now, if you're interested in more ways that I can help your business, or maybe you want to be a guest on the Roundtable Talk Show, please visit my website at asksharifa.com. Until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Pacific, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.